You're listening to All the Best. I'm Belinda Lopez. Do you remember the children's book, My Place, by Nadia Wheatley and Donna Rawlins? I've still got a dog-eared copy of it on my shelf. It traces through the one spot in Sydney, back through several generations of families living in the same place. And today, on All the Best, we're taking you on a similar journey in the Rocks, Sydney, all the way back to the earliest days of Australia's first penal colony. We're telling these stories as a part of the Rocks Windmill Festival, currently being held in Sydney. It's focusing on early British settlement, but Australia's got a tradition of storytelling that stretches back thousands and thousands of years, long before convicts and soldiers arrived on these shores. In the Rocks, Sydney, the stories were told by the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of this country. On All the Best, we're really proud to follow in their footsteps in telling stories about the land. And today, our first storyteller is Jessica Minchell. She's with me in the studio. Hey, Jess.
Hi, Belinda.
You first saw the connection between these stories and Nadia Wheatley's book, My Place, and we're going to chat a bit more about that after we play your story. Here it is, Death at the Gasworks.
I'd been living in a tiny terrace house in St. Peter's for almost a year before my housemates and I recognised its childhood familiarity. If we applied a coloured pencil photographic filter to the old brickwork smokestacks, park and polluted creek, we very much could be living in the exact house as families in Nadia Wheatley and Donna Rawlins' much-loved picture book, My Place. The idea of adding our lives to the narrative should have brought a little joy into our cramped existence. But by then we were desperate to leave the rising damp, black mould, flight path and the dust that swept in the cracks under closed doors and masking taped up windows from the industrial tip out the back and in through the front from roaring, churning wheeled trucks, depositing the final traces from their loads into air that settled on our floorboards, leaving the soles of our feet black and paranoia in our lungs. This was the year Dart Energy was preparing to drill coal seam gas behind our house. And when I first saw footage of people in the States living near such plants, talking illness and setting their kitchen taps alight. Unable to add gas leak to an ever-growing list of fears, we moved away.
Tragedy in Sydney.
Suffocated by gas.
What I saw, what I heard, what I smelt, what I touched, what I tasted, what I thought, what I feel, what I know.
Barangaroo, the strip that joins Darling Harbour to Miller's Point, has a lot in common with my former home. Redevelopment works have excavated the layers of history in the form of asbestos and the toxic remains from the city's first gasworks. This waste will be reworked, remoulded into shape, fit for a new green space on the headland, much like how Sydney Park was formed.
Tragedy.
Gas.
1841. The Australian Gaslight Company establishes itself in its spot on the harbour. And as the streets begin to brighten, the sandstone below is introduced to benzene, cyanide, polycyclic, aromatic hydrocarbons.
Oh yeah.
Still polluted, harmful today, I can't help but think what it would have been like to have had the fully operational gasworks for a neighbour. Princess Street, Miller's Point, just a stroll away. Albert Sorensen was 22 when he died from a gas leak that ballooned into the room as he slept. This was 1903, September, and Albert's fate was syndicated in newspapers as far as Albany, Western Australia, and Rockhampton, Queensland.
A serious case of suffocation resulting in the death of a young man occurred in Princes Street today.
Sydney, September 11.
Albert Sorensen and two lodgers named John Nelson and Frederick Hillman slept in a room, the air from which had been practically excluded.
About 7 o'clock in the morning.
5 minutes to seven.
Conrad Sorensen, father of the young
went
man,
went to the front room on the ground
after repeated
floor.
Knockings,
called his son and receiving no answer, entered.
He shook his son by the arm but got no response. The two other men were in an equally deep stupor.
Detected the presence of gas.
Poisoned with escaping gas.
Sorensen then thought of a slight odour of gas that he had noticed as he opened the door, which, with the admission of the drought, seemed more pronounced. He called for help, and with assistance, carried the three men onto the veranda.
The men were carried into fresh air and medical aid was summoned.
Doctors Wright, Lockheed and Purcell.
When the medical men arrived, Hillman and Nelson were, with considerable difficulty, restored in partial consciousness and sent to the hospital.
An exceedingly narrow escape.
But young Sorensen was past aid and died 40 minutes later.
An examination of the room showed that the gas had escaped through the chandelier being pulled too far down.
He had retired to rest in the best of health.
A verdict of accidental death was returned at the inquest on Sorensen.
They had gone to bed at 11 p.m. in a room with two windows and a fireplace, but the door, fireplace grate and the windows were all shut tight. John Nelson, the coal lumper, who would have been boarding close to his work, didn't survive the weekend. With not much else to glean from these short newspaper clippings, I've searched out Layla Elmus, historian with the City of Sydney's History Unit.
It would have been kind of an interesting, quite dynamic place to be in, and I think the historical imagination can take you anywhere.
And there's some extra imagining to do. This street that stood on the edge of the rocks 110 years ago disappeared with the building of the Harbour Bridge.
The gasworks itself was quite a large complex by that period. It had a massive chimney, so there would have been a lot of smoke that would have been coming out of that chimney, and it would have been dominant on the horizon of people's lives.
I found a photograph of Princess Street that would have been taken, I think, 2 years before mm-hmm. this incident in the yep. State Library. And it's this wide, empty street and yes. a whole mix of different houses. There's a few terraces, a few sort of more cottage style, and then maybe a pub or a shop. But I guess what I mostly felt was this expanse of space that I can't even imagine now, because that place doesn't...
It doesn't exist, and you have to wonder why the photo was taken. Because if you think of that period, there was an outbreak of bubonic plague in 1901, which swept through Sydney. It killed a number of people. It was highly infectious. And so part of the reason for taking those photographs was basically an excuse for, you know, what people had been wanting to do for a long time was slum clearance.
There were some other reports about people being, in the middle of the night, rowed across to the quarantine station near Manly.
Yeah.
Is that too much of a jump to then try and understand as to the reason why this room would have been so shut tight up against the outdoors?
Who knows? I mean, some people, you know, even today, some people like a drafty room and other people like it all closed up. But I think it is probably a reaction to the fear of disease.
When I think of my house in St. Peter's, it's the unease and confusion I remember. I still don't understand why I grew vegetables when I didn't trust the soil enough to eat them, or why I would sometimes eat them anyway. So how do I try to imagine what people living near industry would have thought 110 years ago in the case of Albert Sorensen, or 150 years ago for George Pusey?
George Pusey, he lived with his family on Cumberland Street in the Rocks. He had immigrated from England in his early 20s with his new bride.
And his story caught Layla's attention because he died suddenly in his mid-30s and at the Tarbin Creek Asylum in Gladesville. This was 1863.
I was able to look at the medical case books and went through them all, and then I found the records that related to his death. And he had been working as a gas purifier at the gasworks. And that would have been an extremely toxic place to work. In the 19th century, gas was produced from coal. Before the gas left the plant, they had to purify it. And one of the things that they used was lime. And one of the byproducts of lime purification of coal gas is cyanide.
And at any point, did people at the time draw a link between his work at the gasworks?
Well, I can read to you, if you like, his records. So it says here that George Pusey was admitted to the Tarbin Creek Lunatic Asylum on the 21st of April 1863. And then 3 days later, it was reported that his wife Lucy had visited him at the Tarbin Creek Asylum. And she stated that he was always a temperate and healthy man till a year ago. He had a short attack of paralysis, which required little attention and soon passed away. Sometime after that, however, he had another of a similar character, which soon left him without any manifest injurious effect. But then she says, around 7 weeks since, so 7 weeks before April when he's admitted to Tarvin Creek, he was a third time seized with a severe paralytic affliction of his limbs, which continued unabated in spite of every remedial means. The medical record shows that these fits or seizures that he was having were leaving him physically weakened. But what's interesting is that the case notes suggest that his workplace, which was the gasworks at Darling Harbour, were the cause of illness, and I quote, "The cause is supposed to have been overwork in an unhealthy situation." So it's really unclear. They wouldn't have had the medical knowledge then to probably tie all those things together, having cyanide from the lime purification process as being the cause of his death. But he was definitely having epileptic or some kind of seizure or fit, and then, yeah, died quite suddenly from the effects. I guess I just sort of found it interesting that his cause of death was a workplace incident. And it wasn't necessarily, a lot of people work in hazardous and have worked in hazardous occupations where they're crushed by a train or by a wool bale and all of that sort of stuff. But the way that he died was probably because of poisoning, which was not necessarily something that's a physical manifestation and certainly wasn't identified at the time. So in terms of industrial Sydney, it's quite a different landscape to what it is now. Sometimes we can mythologise the past and not realise that it's living with us, but not always in the most congenial of ways. The fact that this industry was there from the 1840s and is still causing contamination in our 21st century cities is quite scary. Because you're sort of thinking, what are we doing now and how is that going to impact on future generations?
That piece was produced by Jessica Minchell, who's with me here in the studio. Jess, it's interesting that you mention My Place, a children's book, because your piece is actually quite dark. It's about a place being contaminated and staying contaminated over several generations. How did you feel about the actual site when you were recording?
Yeah, it's actually really interesting because despite having this residency in the middle of the rocks for the last 2 months, I was actually a bit nervous about walking up to the Barangaroo end of the rocks, partly because there had been a whole bunch of articles in the paper talking about newfound asbestos contamination at Barangaroo, at the site that they're currently doing the redevelopment of that I mentioned in the story. There was all of that talk, if people remember, about how there were pedestrian walkways open to the public despite workers needing to be dressed foot to toe in protective gear. And I thought that it was a bit unfair to finish off this piece without actually walking the streets. And so I did walk up through the Argyle Cut, up past Windmill Place, the Windmill Street, and up until the top of the cliff where you can actually look through the fence and down into the construction site. And I looked over the cliff for about 2 seconds because I saw a worker below dressed dressed with a mask, and then I turned around and walked past an open cafe and houses all the way back down to Secular Quay. Maybe this piece does come from a little bit of a disconnect between public information and how safe land is for us.
And it's really interesting because I grew up in Sydney and I always think of Sydney as a safe place, and especially at the rocks, you've got, you know, the sparkling water, the harbour, this really beautiful view. It's not the kind of place that you'd think of as unsafe, but you know, you drew on the example of your former home.
Yeah, I think that year of living in that terrace house in St. Peter's was really pivotal in terms of changing how I view this city as potentially a contaminated space. I mean, it's quite funny to think that maybe the place that you live in could be harmful. And that was really when a couple of my housemates and I, we were really quite slow. It was sort of 11 months it took us to realise that we lived in one of the houses that very much could be the exact house in My Place.
The children's book.
In the children's book. And I don't know if that is necessarily meant to be a specific house, but it certainly has the brickworks and the park and the McDonald's, and I think it's a pretty safe guess there.
I actually think it's really sad that one of my favourite children's books, that you lived on that very location and you worked that out only because it was something of an industrial wasteland. It's a bit sad.
But maybe that's also what the indicator was, because that book is very much about the pollution. And I think that that's something that I remember really strongly about that book from reading it in primary school, is that polluted creek that all of the kids who are, you know, 10 or so draw on their hand, draw a map of their suburb.
Until, of course, we reached the end of the book where the traditional owners weren't facing that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Well, thanks, Jess, so much for telling your story.
Thank you.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Belinda Lopez. We're taking you back through generations of one spot in Sydney, inspired by the children's book My Place Today. And that place is The Rocks. And our next storyteller is Madeline James. Hey, Maddie.
Hey, Belinda.
So we're starting out in a very specific location. You're going to take us back in time. And I believe the place is Windmill Street in The Rocks.
That's right.
Okay, let's go there.
Wadani.
Wadani.
Tallawalada. Garba Gully.
Tallawalada.
Okama Gully.
Jabba Gully.
Ta-da.
Okama Gully. Ta-da.
Merriman Street.
Ferry Lane.
Boat Street.
Dawes Point.
The Quarries.
Coops Lane.
Jones Wharf. Bots Wharf.
Lower Fort Street.
Shepherd's
Ferry Lane. The Paddington's Wharf.
Windmill Street.
Mill. Cripps Lane.
Harbour's
Wharf. Marinow Street. Lower Flight
Street.
Mill Lane.
Mill Lane.
Mill Lane.
Windmill Hill.
Windmill Street.
Windmill Street.
Millers Point.
I'm standing on a headland looking out at one of the best views in Sydney. The bridge is arcing over the harbour, the finger wharves are below me. The Blue Mountains are in the distance, and perhaps if the wind blows the right way, I'll catch a strain of the music coming from one of the many pubs at my feet.
I wrote to the Herald, I think, about 25 years ago. I said, not is only this unique in Sydney, New South Wales, Australia, I said, it's unique in the world. Here you have this village, this real village in the heart of metropolis.
That's the voice of Chris. He lives in the community on this point and calls himself a blow-in because he's only lived here for 40 years. We're sitting outside his local pub, the Hero of Waterloo.
Oh, you must come in on a Saturday or Sunday,
yeah,
and
ask.
See Valda. Valda is 86. Is she 86 or older? She's 86. She's as big as a bee's knee. She plays the trumpet, the flugelhorn and the saxophone and sings. And she's been playing here for 30 years.
So where am I? Well, you know the point, of course. And you might even know its name. But I've come here to find out the story behind the name. To discover, well, to find out exactly what is the point.
So what are we on now? We're on Lower Fort?
Lower Fort, yes.
And what's this one going down?
Windmill.
Oh, that's Windmill there.
Yeah, Windmill Street.
Okay.
But I was on my...
The street up here, that's...
Argyle.
Argyle, okay.
And I was on my third generation serving me in that shop.
Before Valda, before Chris, before the Argyle Road was cut and the Hero of Waterloo was built, this rocky point was here, jutting out into the harbour. And there would have been beaches at its base where Gadigal women built campfires to cook fish they caught in their nowies. And on the briny breeze, instead of hearing music from the pubs, you would have been able to hear the women singing to the fish, attracting them to their nets.
Wadani. Tallawalada.
Wadani.
Jabba Gully.
Tallawalada.
Wakama Gully.
Jabba Gully.
Ta-da.
Wakama Gully. Ta-da.
We actually know that the Aboriginal name for the point is Kudji, and variants, depending on how you sort of spell it and listen to the sounds, could be Goodji or Goodji or Kudji. My name's Lisa Murray and I'm the city historian at the City of Sydney Council. So that was the Aboriginal name for the point. And then because it actually led around into Cockle Bay, it was also very early on in a plan of 1807 called Cockle Bay Point.
In the early days of the colony, an emancipated convict called John Layton arrived on Cockle Bay Point. He'd come over to Sydney in 1804 on a convict ship and served his time, and then took out a land grant on the rocky point west of Sydney Cove, right up the road from where the Hero of Waterloo would later be built. We know he was living here by 1816 on this point because he put an ad in the Sydney Gazette.
Lost on the Parramatta Road, a saddle and bridle. Any person who may have found the same and will return it to John Layton, Miller, at Cockle Bay, will receive £2 reward. But if found in any person's possession after this advertisement, they will be prosecuted.
John Layton, Miller, built himself 3 windmills on this point, and pretty soon came to be known as Jack the Miller in the surrounding community. The track that led to this place became known as Windmill Street. And so we come to the present-day name of the point.
It was a nice, prominent point that captured the wind, and, of course, wind power was essential for grinding grain, so getting flour to the colony. So Jack the Miller was the, I guess, first businessman in the district, and he established a number of mills, and they were real landmarks in Sydney's early townscape. And very soon people started referring to the area as we're going over to Jack the Miller's Point, and then that became Miller's Point.
There's a story that does the rounds about Jack. Apparently he was offered the whole of the point if he could pay for a fence across its boundary. And Jack weighed up the parcel of land being offered on top of what he already owned against the cost of the new fence and decided it wasn't worth it. It's most likely apocryphal, but we do get a sense of his character from another ad he took out in the Sydney Gazette.
This is to caution the public against giving credit to my wife, Anne Layton, or my son, David Layton, as I will not be answerable for any debts they may contract from this date. John Layton, May 18, 1824.
So Jack the Miller had emerged from his convict shackles to be a landowner and a mill operator and, well, perhaps just a little bit frugal. All was looking up for him, though, until, on a June day in 1826, it all came crashing down.
A coroner's inquest was held on Thursday last on the body of Mr. Layton, the proprietor of a flour mill in Cockle Bay.
Unfortunately, John Layton, Jack the Miller, had a very unfortunate death.
The Australian, 24th of June, 1826. From the evidence adduced on the inquest, it appeared that the deceased had some few minutes prior to his being found dead left his house and proceeded towards a mill in the neighbourhood, which he tenanted. At this time, he was evidently in a state of intoxication.
And he actually fell from one of his windmills while he was drunk.
The deceased was discovered in the interior of the building, extended, bleeding and lifeless along the ground floor. A verdict of accidental death was recorded.
After his death, Jack the Miller's family stayed on living on their rocky promontory, working the flour mill and renting out property. Just 3 months later, David was charged with repeated assaults on his mother, Anne Layton, whereby she declared her life to be in danger. And in December, Jack's widow Anne was back in court, charging one of her tenants with assault. In just a few decades, Coogee had become Cockle Bay Point, which had become Jack the Miller's Point, which in turn just became Miller's Point.
And I think one of the things about the names around Miller's Point is that they do reflect very much the local contribution of people. That's part of the, I guess, the heritage significance of place names is capturing that.
James Wharf, Botts Wharf,
Mill Lane,
Shepherd and Algar's Wharf,
Merriman Street,
Lettington's Wharf,
White,
Jones Wharf,
Miller's Point, Dawes Point, Mill Lane, Mill Street,
Mill Lane,
Miller's Point.
Of course, there aren't any flour mills on the point these days, but if you stand where I am right now on the corner of Merriman and Bettington Streets, you'll be roughly on the spot where Jack built one of his windmills. Listen closely and you might hear the sound of their wooden sails spinning giddily in the harbour breeze. But try and walk to the far edge of the point as it was in Jack the Miller's day, and you'll have a fall of your own. Not off a windmill like Jack, but over the edge of a cliff that was carved out of the point in the 1920s. And where would you land? On the work site of the new suburb of Barangaroo. So what's behind the name Barangaroo? Well, that's a story for another day. It's time to head back down Windmill Street, past the terrace houses, wool stores and luxury apartments. I'm hoping to get back to the pub in time to catch Valda and the band.
That piece was produced by Madeline James, telling the story behind the name Miller's Point, originally known as Coogee or Gooji on Gadigal land, a part of the Eora Nation. Do you think it's just part of human nature to give names to a place, Maddie?
I think it is. I think we use names to orient ourselves in space, and I think it's really important that we have kind of definitions of spaces to work out where we are. What I found really interesting in researching this story was that we gave names to streets really early on, like official names, but areas within Sydney weren't defined until the 70s. They were bringing in postcodes and they introduced this board called the Geographic Names Board, which is in Bathurst of all places.
Yeah, why Bathurst?
I have no idea. But that's the place that kind of officially in the 70s defined suburb names. So prior to that, they were just they just came about through usage.
So those names existed kind of colloquially but not formally.
Yeah. So it might be somebody's name, like obviously Jack the Miller. They refer to a place or they refer to sort of a geographic space like the rocks, because when the first settlers arrived, it was this crazy rocky headland that they couldn't get over. So it kind of...
Makes sense.
It makes sense. If you think about it now, if you actually think about where you live and the name of your suburb, most of us have no idea of the story behind it.
I've got no idea.
Yeah, I don't either. I live in Surrey Hills. I don't know if that's relating back to Surrey in England, but it's spelt incorrectly. So I don't know, is Surrey a person? It's obviously a hilly area in Sydney, but it's just a kind of symbol to me, a sort of empty symbol, until you start to discover the story behind it.
So that's homework for us all this
exactly.
week. Go and find out the background to your suburb. Thank you, Madeline, for telling this story. And that's it for this week. All the Best is produced at FBI Radio Sydney in association with Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ in Brisbane and SYN in Melbourne. Our show is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. And the documentaries you heard today were produced during a residency for the Rocks Windmill Festival. It's on at the moment, with many thanks to the Sydney Harbour Foreshore Authority for that. I'm the Features Executive Producer of the show. Our production manager is Carly-Ann Keneally and our Executive Producer is Jordana Caputo. See you next week.